You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist, which should be going out Thanksgiving Day in the U.S. 2024. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Before I start, I'm going to be moving shortly, so I'm going to be skipping probably next week and maybe the week after some of my recordings. So how long, I'm not sure. I'll be able to do the next Orthodox Nationalist, but likely not the next Daily Nationalist. But we're going to talk about the nightmare today. That is Donald Trump's cabinet picks, especially in the realm of foreign policy. And as always, we select articles, or I do, concerning the issue and go through them, criticizing them, expanding on them, whatever's necessary. And it's always fitting to start with one of my favorites, Paul Craig Roberts. And he starts off, this is either yesterday or the day before, that Trump has already lost his nominee for Attorney General. He may even lose Bobby Kennedy and Tulsi. But beyond that, his picks for Secretary of State, Security Advisor, UN Ambassador, Ambassador to Israel, Middle East Envoy, etc., are not just Zionists, not just beholden to Israel, but are seeking at least a worldwide conventional war, if not more. The only reason the U.S. is involved, the U.S. gets zero, doesn't get a drop of oil from the Middle East. Therefore, the only reason that they could be there is to defend Israel, such as the power of the Jews, which, you know, none of these writers, except possibly Paul Craig Roberts, will bother to mention. So this has gone beyond simple stupidity and has veered off into some kind of sociopathy. Especially when direct attacks on Russia are concerned, which is something that was never even considered during the so-called Cold War. The U.S. now is officially at war with Russia, although it has been unofficially since at least the Obama administration, if not before. You have NATO with the new leadership there, openly talking about preemptive strikes. This is beyond extraordinary. Paul Craig Roberts says that this is the present moment. It is only Putin's patience that stands between life and death. And as always, Russia is the center of the world, and in particular, one man holds the fate of the world in his hands. Of course, he's far more intelligent. He's far more diplomatic than anyone in the West. But pushing and pushing and pushing now for at least 20 years is going to have serious consequences. Rob Bauer, who I've mentioned before, is an admiral. He is just, you know, not just ignorant, but absolutely living in his own bubble. He is the head of the NATO Military Committee. And he came out and publicly said that NATO has changed. It's not a defense organization. It's become an ideological first strike force. And here's what he says. It is more competent not to wait, but to hit launchers in Russia in case Russia attacks us. A combination of precision strikes is needed that will disable the systems that are used to attack us, and we must strike first. And, you know, Roberts correctly says that this is the triumph of evil. Not that any of this should be surprising, though. I don't like sensationalist claims about Armageddon. I don't like any of this. It's that it's that headline-grabbing nonsense, talking about World War III constantly for 40 years. But if there's ever a time, and it wasn't in the early 60s, it's now, where this could be the case, and of course it's entirely the fault of the West. But I want to say it's not so much the ignorance of these people we're talking about here, but the fact that they start believing their own propaganda, given the nature of censorship. Any alternative idea does not get through their day-to-day reading or viewing, or the advisors that are telling them what's going on. They honestly believe that this kind of talk might work. But whenever you get an actual military man talking about mass casualties, including of his own men, you know that he's probably a political appointee. And let me quote Paul Craig Roberts again. That was on actually yesterday, the 25th. He said, "For a person of my generation, this callous disregard for human life, as Western leaders proclaim, is incomprehensible. With nuclear war on the table, the task is to defuse the threat, not inflame it. But the insane West has chosen to inflame it, and the people of the West are completely unaware. Media lies to them and withholds real information. Those few of us who bring reality to the people barely receive enough support to keep the websites operating. For our troubles, we are called names and are subject to the FBI calling on us." Media, of course, as I've said a million times, is key as far as the regime is concerned. When he says the West, what he's talking about is the regime. So an article, and some of the articles I'm citing here are a mixed bag in terms of quality. One of the better ones comes out from Medea Benjamin and Nicholas Davies. And their first line is really the thesis here, that Donald Trump's campaign promises to end at least the war in Ukraine in 24 hours, and almost as quickly, and Israel's war in the Mideast, will be just rhetoric and ignored. And we know this because of who he has chosen. I when I heard the name Marco Rubio, who always hated Trump, who wants a global war, and that sounds like just a wild sensationalist accusation, but it's absolutely true. And for that ignoramus to be Secretary of State is just a mockery of the office. Mike Waltz and the NSA, and the absolutely ridiculous Pete Hegseth of Secretary of Defense, not to mention Lee Stefanik, UN ambassador. About the only, and he goes back and forth on this, but the only good thing Rubio's probably ever said in his whole life was back in April, Vance and Rubio voted against a roughly $100 billion aid bill. And of that, $61 billion was for Ukraine. He was on the Today Show, and he said, I'm quoting him here, "I think the Ukrainians have been incredibly brave and strong when standing up to Russia, but at the end of the day, what we're funding here is a stalemate war, and it needs to be brought to a conclusion. I think there has to be some common sense here." And this gets to the heart of what, his concern, of course, is China and Israel. And the U.S. doesn't have the equipment or the money to supply all of them. Rubio wants the onus to shift elsewhere. Now, Vance also said something very good in this regard. On the campaign trail, he said the best way to end the Russo-Ukrainian war is to cede the land that Russia has taken, which is Russian-speaking anyway, so it's clearly Russian, and then for a demilitarized zone, buffer zone, to be established, and neutrality to reign in Kiev. Of course, these are the goals of the special military operation anyway, which are perfectly reasonable. And the U.S. would be doing far worse if there were a parallel situation. And he was attacked by everybody. So even if anyone in this administration, which is unlikely, wants to stop aid to the Ukrainian war, is, there's some fantasy there. The very fact that Rubio says things like it's a stalemate war, not a complete and total and artificially extended Ukrainian defeat. Again, he just hears this, and he hears it so many times. He doesn't hear anything to the contrary, so he really believes that there's no other point of view but this. You have NATO, you have certain power centers in Europe wanting to continue this war and certainly keep the U.S. involved. But it is conceivable that Trump could stand up to this. I mean, he did promise it. Now, more dear to Donald Trump is Israel. And when he first was president, it surprised me. You know, when I was growing up, Donald Trump was you know, becoming more and more famous, completely apolitical. And he made his fortune competing with the Jews in Manhattan real estate. And then later on, New Jersey real estate. So he knows them. He knows them very well. And I thought that since he, and what he said to AIPAC, that first campaign, and that since there's a grudging respect that the Jews give him, that he would be able to stand up to them. But the only thing that I could think of that he did was the AIPAC speech, 2016, where he said, I don't need your money. Well, apparently that's history. Now he does need their money. You recall the first, and I talked about this at great length, his first term brokered the now completely irrelevant Abraham Accords, and the stupid thing by moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which is on occupied land, not even within Israel's borders, and, of course, recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli. Now, there wouldn't be any difference whether, no matter who was president. There's been very little difference in terms of policy towards Israel since the Johnson administration. Trump is even less likely to cut anything to Israel. No president would dare do this. Now, we know from about 10 million sources that roughly 70% of those killed by American weapons are women and children, since these are densely populated areas. That's what makes this war worse than what has come before, although this is very typical Israeli policy. Netanyahu is very pleased with this. It's no coincidence that the day, when it was clear that Donald Trump had won, Netanyahu fired Yoav Gallant, who was against any kind of long-term occupation of Gaza. He wanted to stress the hostage issue rather than killing more Palestinian civilians. And he brought in Israel Katz, who was former foreign minister, who was even worse than Gallant, and has made up a story with zero evidence behind it that Iran has been smuggling weapons from Jordan into the West Bank, which is probably impossible, although I certainly hope they could pull it off. But the extreme Zionist parties, you know, so many times I've mentioned Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, these are beyond the Likud party. They talk openly about ethnic cleansing. And given Jewish control, and you know, the Jewish damage control has been extraordinary, since Jewish groups have come into existence to oppose this, but didn't exist in 2006, didn't exist in the Lebanon War. It's only now that because of Netanyahu's policies domestically, and the legal reform, it became fashionable to oppose not so much Zionism, but him personally. And that has gone a bit out of control. So Donald Trump comes in with a absolutely catastrophic crisis, trying to drive as many Palestinians out of Gaza as humanly possible. Right now, the surviving population is just with next to no food, no shelter, disease is everywhere, few doctors, no access to medical care, with tens of thousands of wounded and dying people. The Israelis have always been, if you remember the first Iraq war in 1990, the first thing when the shooting started that the Israelis did was invade the West Bank. And you know, they say the same for Lebanon as they're saying for Gaza. The fact is that the IDF has done very badly on the battlefield. They've taken heavy casualties, and the official numbers are ridiculous. They've not advanced far into Lebanon. They have been bogged down in Gaza, And so their, you know, typical response is to start slaughtering civilian centers. Now, Hezbollah and allied groups have been digging in for a very long time. These are the highest quality guerrilla forces, even to the point of almost borderline regular forces, without a state that I could think of. And Iran gets worse. Remember, Iran is a scientifically advanced first world state with a first world economy and a first world military. We know what his policy is on that. And it was really only General Mark Milley in Donald Trump's last days as his first term talked him out of invading Iran. He and now his cabinet has withdrew America, the U.S. from the nuclear deal, despite the fact this was civilian nuclear power, although they may be forced into something else later. He ordered the killing of one of the top generals, which we've spoken of here at great length. And but even those who are opposed to this, let me put it this way. The typical analysis, there's one guy, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is against the war in Iran, despite the fact that everyone that Trump has named in any kind of foreign policy position is in favor of one. And that's, you know, but the nature of the catastrophe that would result, this is what Wilkerson says. He predicts a U.S. war in Iran could last for a decade, cost $10 trillion, and still fail to do anything. Airstrikes alone would not destroy the civilian nuclear program, ballistic missile stockpile. So once unleashed, the war would very likely escalate into a regime change war involving U.S. ground forces in a country with 3 to 4 times the territory and population of Iraq, more mountainous terrain, and a 1,000-mile-long coastline bristling with missiles that could sink U.S. warships. But Netanyahu and his extreme Zionist allies believe that they must sooner or later fight an existential war, whatever that is, with Iran if they were to realize the vision of a dominant greater Israel. And they believe that the destruction they have wreaked on the Palestinians in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon, including the murder of their senior leaders, has given them some kind of a military advantage and a favorable opportunity for a showdown with Iran. That's pretty common, but because this guy is a military man, he's trying to avoid the ridiculous casualties that would result of all of this, he still thinks that he's dealing with a third world state. I disagree with the analysis, although I certainly agree with why he's making it. The main issue I have is that Iran would win a war, would defeat the U.S. Remember, the U.S. cannot concentrate forces in one spot for very long, since there's a massive global empire, whether it be Russia, China, certainly Turkey, and even Pakistan. None of those countries would stand idle. The U.S. doesn't have the resources, in every sense of that term, for a war with anyone, let alone a war with a first world power that's been digging in and preparing for this for decades. Given the nature of both the Zionist entity and Ukraine, the U.S. is critically low on ammunition, materiel of all kinds, and obviously would be facing massive casualties that would be very difficult to cover up. So you don't have the money, you don't have the political will, you don't have the manpower, you don't even have the equipment available for a war like this. So if the regime is this stupid, and they are, you know, in the worst Machiavellian sense, it will be another massive, humiliating defeat for the U.S. In other words, I think that Wilkerson's analysis is extremely optimistic, but he's correct, at least in the sense that it would be an absolutely no-win war. The U.S. would be so far out of its element. Remember, the only reason, now the American casualties in Iraq, all the various actions there starting in 1990, was most of the army was diverted to Turkey. The Iraqi army was diverted to Turkey, who was threatening about at least half of it. And the U.S. was paying off Iraqi generals to abandon ship, which is exactly what happened. So you only really had a handful of units that were actually fighting the Americans. Now, roughly by November 10th or November 12th this year, and it may be more as far as I know, but Trump and Netanyahu have spoken on the phone at least 3 times. And the quote directly is, they see eye to eye on the Iranian threat. Trump's hired an idiot, a guy named Brian Hook, the guy who helped him sabotage the JCPOA agreement, as I mentioned already, in 2018. And this guy is going to be coordinating the formation of the foreign policy bureaucrats. And the team, of course, as I mentioned, one or two quotes from Rubio and Vance concerning Ukraine, whether or not that actually goes, that may simply be campaign rhetoric, but there's at least a glimmer of hope for the Russo-Ukrainian war for very obvious reasons, partially to divert money to the Jews. But while there may be a 1% chance in Ukraine, there's a 0% chance in the Middle East and maybe even Iran itself. And this would be exclusively for the security of Israel and for no other purpose. I mentioned Mike Waltz, national security advisor. He is best known as advocating a war on China. But I have to say that he did vote against increasing military aid to Ukraine when he was in Congress. However, and he's, you know, like all these guys, they go back and forth depending on who they're talking to. And there was a tweet where he said the Israelis, which really would mean the U.S., should bomb Iran's nuclear and oil facilities. Of course, they've been saying that for a long time. A certain path to war that, of course, he wouldn't have to fight. Now, the U.N. ambassador, I mentioned already, Elsie Estefanik, her focus is Zionism, like most of these guys. And he, and if you remember, she was questioning these university presidents on that hearing in Congress. After that, the presidents of Harvard and Penn resigned, despite all of them being Zionists, just not necessarily supporters of Netanyahu. If you remember, the first Trump presidency had the Anti-Semitism Action Act, whatever it was called. We talked about it here. But it just doesn't matter who takes over. The policy is basically going to be the same, no matter who wins. But the most I could say in this case is that, you know, the Russo-Ukrainian war really is now just a drain, but no more so than Taiwan or Israel. There's another article here by Jeremy Kuzmarov, and he's not very bright, but he does have a lot of information, simply as facts, that are worthwhile. He doesn't really know what to do with it. And he's one of these guys that thinks that these wars, which are leftist wars against more or less right-wing powers, whether religious or, you know, nationalist or something like that, is somehow a far-right concern. When, of course, it's the left that's screaming for war with these people. So that was irritating. But again, he talks about Rubio back in 2010. The war he really sought was China, Iran, and of course, given his background, Venezuela and Cuba. And going back to 2003, where he supported the genocidal U.S.-Saudi war on Yemen and his support for the war in Gaza and blaming Palestinians for their own deaths, that's very, very typical. And of course, the only reason that he may want to pull aid from Ukraine is that he can rededicate it either to, or Latin America, the Far East, and Israel. You know, the war has been lost a month after it started, but it's been artificially dragged out. The war in Israel's dragging out, but it's not so much artificial as simply they're being defeated. If you remember, I did a lecture on the Hong Kong riots that the U.S. created, and Rubio pushed the Taiwan Peace Through Strength Act, taking that from Ronald Reagan. And one of the researchers of the People's Liberation Army, a think tank, the Grandview Institution, said that this would be a nightmare for the Chinese if Rubio is to go through. But his priority, and I hope he's voted down as Secretary of State, I tend to doubt it. Also, he'll focus on places like Cuba and Venezuela. Now, that's something that the U.S. can have a greater impact on than places around the world. But I want to note, and he does it here, Rubio has always claimed that his family ran from Castro coming to Miami in 1956. The truth of the matter is that his parents were driven out of Cuba by Batista, not by Castro. His grandfather, Pedro Garcia, went back to Cuba after Castro took over and even took a job in the Cuban Treasury Ministry. He eventually had a falling out, but things are always far more complicated than people like this put out. I mean, he may even think that that's what happened with his family, but it's just not the case. So he is at least partially financed by the Fanuel family, which is a Cuban exile family. And according to this author, he was elected to the Florida State House. Rubio started working for Jeb Bush, and somehow in this guy's mind, that's a right-wing job. So sanctions on essentially anyone in Latin America, and we're talking about Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and Rubio said about him, he's picked a battle he can't win. It's just a matter of time. The only thing we don't know is how long it will take and whether or not it will be peaceful or bloody. He recognized, if you remember, Juan Guaido as leader there, despite the fact that this, of course, as always, he's educated in America, he speaks English without an accent, for the most part, and totally unknown to the Venezuelan population. But that's nothing new as far as the U.S. is concerned. The only difference now is that you have someone who's openly talking about this as a good thing. And Venezuela may well be the target of a U.S. military invasion. And he said, Rubio said, that he will not rule this out. And that goes, you know, for Evo Morales, Lula da Silva, who, you know, these aren't, yeah, they, you know, these are national socialists in a lot of ways, but they're certainly connected with the regime. But now Rubio claims that it's a narco regime under Maduro, hoping to get the DEA involved. So he is not ruling out military action in Latin America. Again, a country the size of Venezuela. And I can say the same thing for Mike Waltz, Republican from Florida. He wants Israel to, quote, finish the job in Gaza, which can only mean killing everybody there. So, and unlike, I mean, this guy was an early supporter of the war in Ukraine. And he wanted, even after 2014, he wanted American troops in Ukraine. And of course, according to him, according to Mike Waltz, to take the handcuffs off the long-range weapons we provided to Ukraine. Back in 2020, the murder of Soleimani, Waltz was at least a part of this. He was part of a small group that was briefed at the White House. He has a few tours in Afghanistan. I guess they're combat tours. I don't know. He was opposed to Biden's withdrawal, which actually was a long-term project. He even went so far back in 2017 to say that the U.S. should be there for several generations. So you notice these guys that are being chosen have an area of focus. Either it's China, Latin America, or Israel, or all three. And again, the only reason that Rubio would have anything negative to say about aid to Ukraine is just to free up resources for wars elsewhere. So Donald Trump campaigned as a peace candidate. And if these are the people he's promoting, even Elsie Stefanik, who's a Republican from New York, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., you know, she's a neocon. I mentioned the hearings in Congress, which is ridiculous. Not to mention Huckabee, his selection. And Israeli settlers were rejoicing when he was chosen. His evangelical nonsense, he honestly believes that God granted Palestine to the Jews, who he thinks are the same people as in the Old Testament. And he is personally close to Netanyahu. Huckabee, back in 2008, said that Palestinian identity was, quote, a political tool to try to force land away from Israel. And as far as he's concerned, they could do no wrong. He uses names like Judea and Samaria, and is very supportive of the present cabinet in Netanyahu, both before and after Trump's election. Even his governor of Arkansas, for some reason, he thought that he had the right to weigh in on the Iraq war. And yet, Judicial Watch, many of you know who they are, had him as the sixth most corrupt politician in the U.S. 14 major ethics complaints and a volley of questions about his integrity. Again, this is Judicial Watch. This isn't some leftist, you know, New York Times nonsense. His income was subsidized by nonprofits, and he destroyed state computer files on his way out of the governor's office. But this is the kind of moral standard that we have gotten used to. Again, back to Pete Hegseth, who has no right to be even considered for this. He was a soldier. He won two Bronze Stars. There's two different types of Bronze Stars, if you remember that. And he was a guard at Guantanamo Bay, which, of course, the torture there he defended. He runs a veterans organization that the Koch brothers finance to, quote, rally the country to complete the missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Worse than that, he lobbied for the pardons of, and I've mentioned these guys a long time ago, Lieutenant Clint Laurent, Major Matthew Goldstein, during the first Trump administration, and I've mentioned the support for the SEAL, Edward Gallagher, facing war crimes charges, which, according, if it's against these people, people like Hegseth don't believe that their war crimes are even possible. Running the Pentagon, you know, these kind of war crimes will be basic policy. One of the most obnoxious things about Hegseth is he believes that it's not the military's fault that they were defeated in Afghanistan. He claims, and actually in a couple of books, that the left has betrayed our warriors. Now, while he has a point as far as, you know, the elimination of meritocracy, that certainly has nothing to do with the round defeat of the U.S. in Afghanistan. Scapegoating people because that's the only way he could process the U.S. defeat. The fact that the U.S. is not a superpower, claiming that it's anyone else's fault. And it's very odd that the world's greatest military, according to him, needs to have all of these excuses and project its failures onto anyone else. He can. He has this very romantic idea of the U.S. military. But this whole notion, the Vietnam era argument that politicians have tied their hands, as if, you know, that was even remotely the case. I mean, there's always rules of engagement, which he clearly is against. And that's the reason why the U.S. was driven out of Afghanistan. Let me quote him directly here. I forget which book this was from, but he said, "The wars never end because we're not allowed to fight them properly. We do not bring the enemy to their knees until they will just give up. Just look at the pressure on Israel. They need to go into Gaza and kill every member of Hamas. Politicians have their schemes. I make the argument in the book, the rules of engagement need to be loosened to kill the bad guys. This is what Trump did against ISIS. We fight an enemy that does not play by the rules." The ISIS comment is beyond stupid. Of course, the U.S. supported ISIS, possibly even created it. But these excuses that somehow the U.S. Has lost these wars, not because of itself, not because of their extreme unpopularity, not because of the ridiculous Afghanistan National Army and all the rest of it. No, it's because somehow a politician said that there's rules of engagement. They're not allowed to kill just anybody. Some of you may know that Lloyd Austin, former head of the Central Command, now a board member of Raytheon. And Austin just recently awarded Raytheon with a $10 billion contract for the Pentagon. Actually, that was just in his first 6 months, and much has been done since that. Hegseth wants to recall it the War Department. And then, of course, the CIA director, John Ratcliffe, former DNI, from Texas. Again, he's a lawyer. I don't know how any of these guys, even a soldier, is qualified for any of this, especially given what they're saying. And Ratcliffe is known for his support of the so-called war on terror, and especially the persecution of dissidents at home. You know, he is a neocon through and through, and back in the Obama administration, he supported a bill linking so-called cybersecurity cooperation between the U.S. And Israel. Opened up the Department of Homeland Security to work with Israel, of all things, on border control and maritime and aviation security. And the famous his famous support of Section 702, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, allowing the government to spy on American citizens without a warrant, and he wants to see that extended and even strengthened. Radcliffe was one of the guys who invented the claims that Iran is trying to hack the Trump campaign and trying to kill him. And if you believe that, you are just an incredibly stupid human being. Radcliffe wrote in the Wall Street Journal, actually it was late 2020, he said, "If I could communicate one thing to the American people, it's that the People's Republic of China poses the greatest threat to America today and the greatest threat to democracy and freedom worldwide since World War II. So with some of these guys, it seems that there's going to be a shift to China and Iran. At least they have the knowledge that they can't fight a war on three or four fronts. Again, we'll have to talk about Latin America too. He is not going to oppose, Radcliffe is not going to oppose the politicization of intelligence work. And the only person that really seems to matter here in a positive way is Tulsi, as you know, DNI replacing Avril Haines. I have been talking about Gabbard, if you go way back, long before she was well known, because of a speech on the Syrian war that she made. And the Jews are crazy; they go nuts, they're appalled. They say that Gabbard was even considered, because of course she supports nothing but dictators. So this is a nightmare scenario. The neocons, the leftists, they're one and the same, and overwhelmingly support a massive global war against any right-wing figure. And this is what dumb leftists don't understand. They just hate Trump. You know, now, I'm not saying good things may happen in the domestic front. Maybe. I mean, at least... we could, you know, there's certain things that would have happened under Harris, or she would have been told to do it. How far the regime is willing to push him, that's a separate issue entirely. So, the people who control Joe Biden are leaving Trump with a disastrous situation as far as the long range, or actually medium range missiles, the ATACMS missiles I spoke of last week. And that could, you know, could start long before even, you know, January 20th. And the only person, I think it was one congressman, Tom Massey of Kentucky, who actually tweeted, he said, "By authorizing long-range missiles to strike inside Russia, Biden is committing an unconstitutional act of war that endangers the lives of U.S. citizens. This is an impeachable offense, but the reality is he's a emasculated puppet of the deep state." Well, that's being very diplomatic, but it's essentially true. And it's not just long-range weapons. It's some of these nasty landmines that stay in the ground for years, which were more or less forbidden before. You know, none of this stuff is going to get to Ukraine. It's either going to be destroyed, shot down, or sold for hard currency with global arms dealers. So the BlackRock presidency, using Biden as their front man, their Weekend at Bernie's front man, wants to get this war started before Trump comes in. And it's just for military men to be talking about sending hundreds of thousands to their deaths for the sole purpose of defending Israel. These have to be just simple political appointees. Military men are not really known for their creativity or scholarship. And they seem to accept the romantic idea of the greatest military in the world nonsense. And since there's not a whole lot of opinion to the contrary in the mainstream, or at least that they can access, they actually start believing this. And that's the worst issue at all, living in their bubble. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.